Welcome to Beyond the Stories, a creative business podcast for those looking to find freedom and fulfillment in the work that they do. With me, business coach and therapist, Lauren O'Sullivan. Hi everyone, happy new year. I hope you had a lovely Christmas break. Mine was a pretty chilled one, which was just what I needed, but I'm enjoying getting stuck back into work now this week, starting with this podcast. There's lots going on actually. So this week I recorded my first podcast as a guest with Kate Ferris. So Kate interviewed me for her podcast Grow With Soul, which I really enjoyed. I think it's out this week, so I'll pop the link in the show notes when it's out if you're interested in having a listen. I've also been updating my website and I've actually just launched a new coaching package on my website this week. So if you're looking to make changes this year, whether you're thinking of starting a business but not sure where to start, or you've got a business and want to grow, or maybe you're just feeling really stuck and not sure what's next for you, either way, I'd love to support you on that journey. All the information's on my website, or please get in touch, email me, DM me. I'm always happy to have a chat and answer any questions. Now back to today's show. So I'm really excited about this one. So today's guest is psychologist and author Fiona Murden. Now I first came across Fiona's work at the back end of 2018 when I bought her book Defining You, which I absolutely love. So Defining You is a really practical hands-on book about understanding yourself to unlock your potential to live a more fulfilling, successful life, which is obviously right up my street. So the book includes lots of tests and tasks that Fiona uses as part of her clinical profiling techniques as her work as a psychologist. And it's one of those books that I'm always dipping back in and back out of, and I'm always recommending to clients too. So it was great to chat to Fiona in this episode. We spoke about the reasons why she wrote the book, and we explore some of the themes of the book, including understanding your values, defining your purpose, and overcoming fear and self-doubt to be doing the work you really want to be doing. I absolutely love the opportunity to chat to Fiona. She's such an expert in her field and has some really sound advice that I hope you'll enjoy too. So on that note, here's Fiona. Hi Fiona, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
No, I'm very, very excited. We've already been chatting for I think at least 20 minutes before we've started, and I've got so much to chat to you about. So thank you. Do you want to do a little bit of an intro to yourself, Fiona, and the work that you do?
Okay, so I'm an occupational psychologist. I work with senior leaders, mainly profiling and coaching and working with senior teams as well. Basically, the profiling side is to assess and sometimes develop. Mm-hmm. And if it's assessing, it would be, say, to managing director candidates had been narrowed down by a company, and then I'd do an in-depth 4-hour psychological profile of them to work out
their suitability,
what strengths, suitability for the role. But it's all very transparent. It's not me sitting there with a notepad, not telling them what I think. It's a conversation. And then I write a full personality report, and which covers their areas of strength and areas for development as well. So if they do go into the role, or even if they don't, there's a guideline for what they can do moving forward differently, or where they could seek support, or where they could grow. And typically at senior levels, they'll have a pretty good idea of what that looks like. It's just trying to unwrap it a little bit more. And then executive coaching is what it says on the tin, I guess, and working with senior teams to try and help them operate more effectively together, and also to get the best from the people that work for them. Mm.
So this is all very much about getting to understand people, helping people to understand themselves in a corporate environment. So whatever role they take on, and the people you work with are obviously in very senior roles, roles with high responsibility, probably very, very highly paid roles, they're in the best position to be doing the job that they're being paid to do. And I assume that's benefit for not only the employer, but obviously for the candidate as well, because they're going to be happy and...
Yeah, I mean, even when people don't get... Because if someone's not suitable for a role, it's not me saying, oh, no, I don't think you're going to... It's basically saying that I don't think this role is going to suit you because your core drivers are X, Y, and Z, and that doesn't quite align with where the organization's going. And it's a sort of very adult, it's a decision-making process. It's not sort of someone wagging a finger at them and saying, no, you're not suitable. But I guess the other side to my work that's come about is because I've been very conscious of wanting to give back more broadly, I do a lot more public speaking now, speak to the media a lot more, just trying to raise awareness of the tips and the tools and the techniques that I share with these senior people, because it's always felt unfair to me. It's just them that's receiving this wisdom.
Because ideally, really, you know, to be able to find, you know, a role that suits your abilities and your skills would be amazing if everybody kind of got that opportunity to be exposed to that, particularly at quite a young level as well. You know, if you're thinking of you leaving school or leaving university, it's almost a little bit a stab in the dark, isn't it? The direction you choose to go.
I mean, I think it's so hard for youngsters, and I talk at schools as well, because I just think it's so hard. And I remember back to that age, and I probably was clearer than a lot of people, but yet took many diversions along the way as to what I wanted to do. And how are you supposed to know when you're 16 what you want to do for the rest of your life? And I know that the workplace is changing and evolving, and it's not necessarily a job for life or a career for life anymore, but it's still an awful, it's like huge expectation, I think, on anyone to try and understand what they want to do without any help or guidance.
Definitely. And we were just saying actually before the podcast, but particularly at a young age, you can be so influenced and shaped by the people around you. So whether that's teachers or parents, that influence is quite heavy, and maybe they have really good intentions at the core of their advice. But if that shapes you or influences you in a way that isn't really aligned with your values or your strengths, it can quite early on knock you onto a slightly different path that perhaps isn't suitable that you end up taking.
And I nearly did that. So my physics teacher, I'd said to my physics teacher I wanted to do psychology when I was about 15, and she said, oh, I don't think psychology would be right, I think you should do medicine and then psychiatry. And I was just so flattered that someone had actually taken an interest in me that I then chose A-levels to do medicine and psychiatry. But then I'm working in hospitals and really thinking about it, I thought, I don't think this is the right path for me. And I changed my mind. You know, I'm someone that thinks an awful lot. So it was a well-meaning word from a teacher who I didn't really have a particular connection with, nearly took me down a completely different path. Weirdly, I do work with surgeons and with medicine and what have you now, but that's more around trying to help build emotional resilience in those populations.
And it's like I said, that's such an early age, it's very, very easy, isn't it, to go off on that tangent. And I suppose a lot of the work you do, you know, is very much like we spoke about understanding yourself and building emotional resilience. Actually, those are probably the key skills that will be more beneficial for children to be learning, because they're going to stand them in good stead.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever it is that they choose to do.
Don't get me on that one. There's a whole other soapbox there.
Well, in terms of understanding yourself and you helping people understand themselves, I'm wondering if we could have a little chat about your book that you've written. So you've written a book, Defining You, which was awarded Self-Development Book of the Year 2019. Do you want to chat a bit about what the book is about, and as more as well, the why behind why you came to write it?
The book tries to unpack what I do with clients in a way that makes it usable for anyone. So obviously, it's a bit difficult to go into an in-depth profiling session through a book, but it's also, you have to be careful that you don't send people off on the wrong tangent when it comes to self-analysis, as it were. But it walks through looking at your personal narrative, how your parents have influenced you, what your core drivers are, what your real intrinsic motivations are, what your strengths are, what your passions are. Then looking at trying to understand what meaning means to you. And once you've sort of unpacked all of that, there's a psychometric, which normally costs £100 to do, but you do it, it comes with the book, and you get a free individualized report, which is produced by a separate company, and it's all very confidential. And then it's thinking about, well, how do you put this into action, and how do you maintain your level of well-being through good sleep, through exercise, through making connections with other people, that sort of thing. And the reason I wrote it was because I wanted to share what I'd learned with a wider population.
Yeah, and I think it definitely, it's a really succinct book, but it is very, very practical, because you can tell it pulls all that knowledge and all that learning together, enables you to walk through that process yourself to ultimately come to, I suppose, a mission or a purpose that you can clearly define through going through the processes and tools that you outline in the book.
Yeah, and I think what I found is some people have come back and said, oh, I didn't want to go into my childhood. And other people have said, I found that really interesting. But the thing I've said is, it's dip in and dip out where it works for you. So if someone picks up and they feel uncomfortable going through their earlier years, then don't do it. Use the bits that are useful to you. And there are lots of tools from lots of different psychologists across the world in there. And obviously, I've asked permission from all of them, but academic psychologists. And so they look like quizzes, sort of some of the questionnaires, but they're actually incredibly robust, the information behind them.
With a scientific approach that's, I suppose, going to be
evidence-based, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, at the core of the book is, I suppose, this finding purpose and meaning in life. And that's what I really enjoyed about it. How, for the audience listening today, how would you define purpose and what purpose is?
So purpose isn't a small thing. And one thing I would always warn against is trying to sit down in one go and find your purpose.
Yeah.
Because there's actually evidence to say that people can become depressed from trying to do that. Because it's not easy. And so if you sit down and you try and do it and you don't get the answers you want, it can feel like, who am I? What am I doing? What is my purpose? So purpose is from a psychological perspective, is made up of our strengths, our passions, our values, really understanding ourselves and where that takes us in life. So what, using those strengths, passions, interests, enables us to do it in life. And it's something that is ever evolving. I use David Attenborough in the book as an example, because I think he's great as someone who's, you can see he's always had a purpose. He's always been absolutely passionate about the natural world. But that, what that looks like, has changed over the course of his career because of changes in the world around us and the technologies he's using to communicate. And I think it's really important to remember and realise that we don't necessarily just sit down and say, oh, haha, I've found my purpose in life. It's something that's continually evolving and growing and developing.
Yeah, it's not an end point, is it? And I think the point that you made at the beginning about it not being able to just like being able to sit down and do it in one sitting, I think it's really important, because I think a lot of how I know how my brain works is that you kind of have to go away, you have to reflect, you have to digest things. And that's all part of the process of getting to that understanding of what that means.
Yeah,
what that
means, yeah. And it can be frustrating because you kind of want the answers.
Yeah. And also, it can sometimes be a little bit too big. And you talked about it almost, you know, for some people, maybe having a bit of a, I won't say depressive element, but it's quite a big existential question, isn't it, as well?
It is.
So what that brings up in terms of feelings as well, you know, as a human being on the earth, what am I here to do? I think a lot of people struggle to want to face that sometimes.
Yeah.
And look at that and answer that question.
And I think there's also what we were talking about before we came on, we've talked about a bit on this as well, is it's not about other people's expectations. So it doesn't mean being a neuroscientist or solving cancer or, you know, doing massive things. It can be being a mum. It can be being a friend. It could be helping in your community. It could be being a gardener. It could be it's the thing that makes you feel fulfilled, not what other people think looks good or looks noble. It's what makes you feel fulfilled.
Definitely. And I think, again, going back to what we were saying before the podcast, but I think that's why we talked about going back to your childhood. even though maybe some people might not want to do that, I think that's probably an important step, because it's really difficult to differentiate where we have been influenced by other people, whether it's teachers, family, our friends in our life. Our brains and our opinions and our thoughts are so shaped by other people. It's not always black and white, which are our thoughts and opinions and which are theirs. So it's a process of maybe going through that and peeling off those layers to understand behind that, you know, I suppose, who you are behind all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's not in a scary way. It's actually quite fun, because it's saying, oh, I'd forgotten that time when I was a child and I used to do puzzles and I used to sit and just get lost in doing puzzles.
Mm.
And actually at Christmas, you pick up a puzzle and you do a puzzle and you think, do you know what? I still love doing this.
Mm.
Or it might be, when I was little, I loved painting and I haven't painted for 20 years.
Mm.
You sit down and you do a bit of painting and you might think, actually, it's not me anymore. But it's sort of thinking about it, not as a dark sort of reminiscence of everything that went wrong, but looking at what were the things that made you lose yourself as a child? What were those things that made you so happy? And how do they translate into your life now? Do you even do them?
Yeah. And it is, because if you write a list, even if you just write that simple list about, these are all the things that I enjoyed doing, or these are things that I enjoy, and how much of that have I done in the past week, in the past month, the past 6 months, and, you know, those, you know, it can show up quite a disparity sometimes in terms of what you do enjoy versus what you're doing in your life and how that
Absolutely.
Shows up. So go, I suppose, to that point then, why do you think it is important to have that purpose? I think, one, in your life, and two, in whether it's in the work you do or within your business, why do you think that purpose is important?
Well, again, I mean, looking at evidence, it's what makes us happier than anything else. So having a sense of purpose, it protects us against a whole load of physical illnesses, actually, like Alzheimer's, and helps us to live longer. There's all sorts of evidence around those things, but really it's what makes us happy. So whilst it might not be easy to find, we don't really expect happiness to be easy to find. It doesn't mean that we're walking around with a big grin on our face the whole time. I refer to Viktor Frankl, who was a psychiatrist who was in concentration camp in the Holocaust. And he noticed that people who had a sense of meaning actually survived longer. And if you look at it from the perspective of the way the brain's made up, it links to a lot of our more advanced brain areas. So finding a connection with other people, giving back to society. And as I said, that doesn't have to be in some massive way. It can be, you know, making your garden beautiful and people drive past it and see how beautiful your garden is.
Mm.
But it's connecting us as humans to something bigger than ourselves. And that makes us feel happier than lots of money or a fast car or big house. Those things are nice to have, but a sense of purpose and meaning gives us so much more.
And I think it's just interesting hearing that description. I suppose what that resonates with is, perhaps historically in the past, a lot of that would have come through the setup of society and community.
Absolutely.
And being quite a religious background as well, which, you know, I know obviously a lot of people, you know, religion's still there, but it's not as prevalent as in our everyday lives and in our communities. And it's like we're now having to go back and re-ask ourselves these questions for ourselves, because we haven't got that framework there to follow, probably from religion, really.
Absolutely. And I think that's absolutely, that hits the nail on the head, is religion is missing, which used to give us a lot of the answers. But there's also the community is missing, regardless of religion gives community in itself. But also, you know, we used to have, I mean, when I was growing up, I used to get on my bike and cycle around to my friend's house. Mm. And then we'd go off on a bike ride. I won't let my daughter do that. You know, the roads are too busy. There's all sorts of reasons why we don't do those things anymore. And all of those things mean that we don't have another parent saying, fasten your coat up, you're going to get cold, or don't talk to your friend like that, or the things that, you know, what's that saying, it takes a village to raise a child. But we don't have that anymore.
And we very much left in that isolation, you know, like talking about that phrase about even, you know, bringing up children and having people around us to support us in doing that. It's almost not surprising, really, how the conversation around mental health and depression, anxiety, when you look at all these things that are missing that maybe used to be there, it isn't surprising, really, when you see levels of, you know, mental health and depression seemingly go up.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus the fact that, you know, our technology feeds into the fast thinking brain, which is, again, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. But it means that we're basically in stress and anxiety mode the whole time. Unfortunately, the sort of some people don't get on with the idea of the opposite, which is comes across as sort of self-care, but actually it's being human. It's taking the time out to walk in the countryside, to connect with other people. I mean, connecting with other people is the most important thing.
That's what we're here to do as humans, isn't it? That's, you know, by our natural default.
Absolutely.
What we're here to do. So touching on social media, because I wanted to ask you about this actually, Fiona, in terms of the effect you see it having on our health. I think from that physical point of view, because that was really interesting what you said, how it connects with our fast-moving brain. Could you talk a little bit more about that and explain how that works?
I mean, there's one theory of brain development, which I talk about in the book, which I find the most helpful, and it's a vast oversimplification, but it's called the triune brain theory. And it was developed by a doctor called Paul MacLean. And it basically, people will have heard of the brain stem, which is what monitors breathing and heart rate. And that's the most primitive part of our brain. And then on top of that, there's the limbic system, which is the emotional centers of the brain, which evolved, I think it was 180 million. The neocortex, the part that makes us human, evolved 50,000 years ago. But our brain functions in these layers in a crude, if oversimplified way. So the limbic system, the fast bit of our brain, actually overrides the more advanced bit of our brain whenever we feel like we're in threat of any sort. But the irony is that could be someone sitting in our seat in a coffee shop or someone bumping into us on the train. Anything that makes us feel threatened, that increases our stress levels. Our more rational brain is where we find meaning and purpose and really deeply connect with people. But we don't have much space for that when we're in sort of world of Instagram, Twitter, responding literally here and now to everything the whole time. And so it's not great for our mental health. And then on top of that, I mean, the research says that social media doesn't cause depression and anxiety. However, if someone is already prone to depression and anxiety, it can trigger it. And you can see how. And I personally, I really struggle with Instagram. I have to stay off it because it makes me feel miserable and I can't understand it from a scientific perspective. And my husband gets really frustrated with me because I'll go, why? I don't understand why. But he says, just post and get off. And I'm like, it doesn't work for me.
It's absolutely the number one conversation I have with both my clients, my peers, and something that I experience myself. And I think it's really challenging because a lot of what I do and a lot of the people that I work with, we're women of a certain age and we're using Instagram as the main vehicle to build the businesses that we want for ourselves. So for what we do, it isn't actually possible without Instagram because that's where we're looking to meet our audience. That's where we're looking to build up our profiles and ultimately, you know, meet customers and clients. And I time and time again have that same conversation that your husband does with you, with myself and with my clients. It's this real negativity towards posting, and it is kind of like you're in this stress mode quite a lot when it comes to posting on Instagram. And I know that I'm not the only one like that. Like I said, these conversations come up from time and time again. And when I think about it, I know that in, like you said, in terms of scientific research, social media doesn't cause depression, anxiety, and mental health issues. But I think what social media does is it opens up. If you're quite, I think a lot of women are quite perfectionistic. I think we look to other people to measure our success and our self-worth. And if you would have gone back, if we go back to that village scenario where it had been 50, 100, 150 years ago, the only people we would have to measure ourselves against would be the people in our village. So you might not have been the cleverest, you might not have been the most attractive, you might not have been making the most money, but you could probably had your place within that village, within that setting. Now, where social media, and particularly Instagram, opens up that possibility for comparison to everybody on the planet, basically. Yeah.
I don't know who, someone said, why compare your reel to everyone else's showreel? And I mean, that's the other element. I think you're totally spot on, because suddenly it's everyone on the planet, but it's also not a realistic image of everyone on the planet.
No. And I think logically we know that, but I think emotionally we don't. I think there's something in a part of us that still buys into that. Even if we're having those logical conversations with ourselves, it doesn't truly ring true. Do you have any advice, Fiona, in terms, I know you said you kind of take yourself away from social media. Maybe that is the advice, really. But how would you navigate the mental challenges of using social media, particularly, I think, to run your own business when it has to be that, it has to be there, it has to be a part of what you do, but maybe you're finding it difficult or you're struggling with it?
I'm probably not the best person to ask, actually. I really struggle with it. So publishers expect me to be on social media. And the way I'm going to move forward with it is to focus on more of a campaign angle rather than me. And I think probably my husband's advice isn't bad. You know, you post and you get off. You don't hang around on there. You know, there are other mediums. So LinkedIn, I find a lot less corrosive. And LinkedIn's very important for growing business. It's kind of finding the place that feels most comfortable. I personally, I don't think we should have to be on all of them. So it's which platform feels least like it takes away yourself for you personally. And then use that. And it might mean starting from 5 followers, but, you know, just stick with it. Because I also think, although it's important for building business, there are a huge number of other ways that we do and build business. If you look at some of the most successful people in the world, they've never even put their toe in the water of social media. And I know that that's built on a world that was different, but I do think it's kind of try and be in the real world, meet people, talk to people, connect, do the things that are human.
It goes back to, you know, Instagram didn't exist, did it, you know, 10 years ago. So, you know, sometimes asking yourself that question, if it didn't exist, what would I be doing in that scenario to connect and meet people?
And it's not saying don't use it, and it's not saying don't leverage it as a tool, but I think it's just remember that actually word of mouth still exists, networking still exists, those other things still operate as ways of meeting people and building business.
No, I think that's a really important point, definitely. Going back to your book, one of the chapters that you write about is finding your strengths. And one question that I get asked quite a lot by people is recognizing what value they have to offer in the world. I think clients come to me and perhaps they're stuck in jobs that they're unhappy with, or they know they want to do something different, but they don't know quite what. And they struggle really to pinpoint the value they personally have to offer. Do you have any advice on that?
What I see most often is with people that are struggling to see what their strengths are, they're the things that they do most naturally.
Yeah, and this is so true.
It's the things that people say, oh, but that's not a strength. Everyone can do that.
And it's because you're using it so naturally.
You can do that. And that's because it's a strength.
Yeah. It was just taking me back, actually, to kind of like those things we learn in school and those concepts around work and things like that. But we have often taught that things need to be difficult in order to achieve them. And I think when something comes really naturally to us and we don't have to work at it, I think there's definitely something there that almost devalues it in our brains that says it's not worth having because I've found it so easy to do it. And it's like it becomes wallpaper. We don't recognise it.
I think that's very true. And I think, you know, I speak to very senior men and women who still struggle to see what their strengths are. And when you talk them through and you say, well, actually, your ability to read the team and the mood and to navigate and to pull people together that's a strength. Oh no, but everyone can do that. No, they can't. Mm-hmm. It's and so sometimes it's asking other people, what do you see as my strengths? What are the things that I bring to the party that other people don't?
Because it's much easier for somebody to be objective and see those things in you that it's hard to do yourself.
Absolutely. And then it's just being open to the fact and remembering that things that, you know, don't close them down because they feel like they're so natural and part of what you do that surely that's what everyone does. Mm-hmm. So be prepared to accept that that's different.
Mm-hmm. And it may not be, you know, the traditional strengths or strengths that are traditionally valued, but leaning into those ones that really resonate with you or you're really good at, that's that playing to your strengths in that way is going to be your unique USP almost, isn't it? What's going to make you different and stand out.
Yeah, absolutely.
The chapter that I enjoyed most in the book, actually, Fiona, that I found personally really helpful and I always point my clients to is the values section, because I think this it is such a useful exercise, really thinking about something in a way that I'd never really thought of before. Can you talk a bit about what values are and why you think they're important?
Yeah, so values are, they're what we stand by. They're sort of like our moral guide almost, but they're the things that if we see them violated really upset or annoy us. If I take myself as an example, when I was at school, when I've been in the workplace, if I saw anyone being treated unfairly, it would make me so cross. Mm-hmm. And actually at my sixth form, I went and complained to the headmistress about the way some of the girls were being treated who were being made to drop A-levels, because I believed that they were doing it for the league tables rather than doing it for the good of these girls. I was quite shy at that age, but it was something that got me so angry that it sort of made me rise up and do something. Mm. And that sort of stuck with me through life. If I ever see anyone treated unfairly, it makes me really angry. Now, we could say we all feel like that. We all feel like we don't want to see people treated unfairly. But it's what are the things for you that really make you your blood boil if you see it violated? What are the things that make your heart sing? So it might be that a real value for you are aesthetics, for example. And some of the creatives I work with, they have to have beauty and things that look beautiful and have a sort of design aspect to them, around them. That's one of the things that feeds who they are.
Noticing your emotions and asking yourself that question, whether you're angry or jealous, is a really interesting one, I find. And really unpacking those feelings, noticing them first of all, and then unpacking those feelings and asking yourself what that feeling means to you, I think can often bring to the surface those values of what we find really important, even if we don't know immediately what our values are.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's another one that sort of takes some time and exploring, but it should be fun. It shouldn't feel like it's hard work.
It's one of the most enjoyable things I've done. I think I probably first looked at this probably about 4 years ago, and this was before I'd had done any training in psychology or anything like that. And it's just something that I'd started to delve into and look more into myself. And it was interesting, really, because I kind of had an idea of what this was before I came to your book. But when I went through the exercise that you've outlined in the book, it really did crystallize it and clarify that process that I'd started. But it had probably been about 2 or 3 years of reflection. And again, I think you do need that reflection time in order to get a real genuine response. But once you get those values, I think you look at them and it almost feels exciting. It feels really expansive. It feels like you've got you there on the page. Or that's how it felt like for me anyway. And I took a lot from that experience to have those values there and to have them, like you said, as that guiding compass almost.
Yeah, and I think it should feel like that, and it's great that it does.
I think that's when you know that you've got them right, when they feel exciting in that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we chatted a little bit before about finding your right people. and being in the right environment. In your experience, how important is that to find your right people in your right environment to be able to really flourish as a human, I suppose?
I think it is really important. It's really hard as well, because there are the realities of work, and can't always sort of look around and think, these are exactly my people. So there's balancing it with the reality, and it's finding commonality and connection with people who aren't like us as well. I mean, probably the best example for me there is being a mum at school. I suddenly realised that I surrounded myself in London with interesting, driven, multicultural people. And then sometimes, you know, I've made some fantastic friends who are mums at school, but you feel you're thrown together with these people and you look around and you think, but you're not like me. And I think I'm open-minded and I accept everyone. But then you forget that the type of people you're coming across through work tend to be, even if they're diverse, a certain type of people. And it's stopping yourself and thinking, it's a balance. It's saying, if you're completely surrounded by the wrong people in a job that just feels totally like it's draining the life out of you, it's probably time to move. But you can't necessarily find an environment where it's only your type of people around you. And I guess it's finding out how to connect with everyone and to really see the value in people who are different from us. And that sounds obvious. And I sort of prided myself in it, always doing that. But then I realized suddenly there I was with looking at people who seemed nothing wrong with these people whatsoever. But I just couldn't feel that sense of connection with them. But it's that balance between saying, who are the people that make me feel really good about myself, make me feel really alive, who I really enjoy? But how do I also connect with the people who don't make me feel those things?
And it is, I think that balancing is really important, because, you know, we're never going to be in perfect environments or ideal environments. And we're always kind of going to have to work with people or do things that perhaps, you know, we don't 100% want to do. But it's knowing when when you're feeling that square peg in that round hole constantly, or you're constantly moving against the grain, I suppose it's then making that decision, well, maybe this isn't the best environment for me to be in.
Yeah, totally. I think it like you said, it's this constant with self-awareness. It's this constant checking in and thinking, how much is this depleting my energy? Is it a little bit, or is it actually just completely draining me? And it's when it's ongoing and completely draining that it's time to think about being somewhere else.
I think another point that I really wanted to ask you about that relates to this. So this is something that I struggle with quite a lot at the moment. So running my own business, you're constantly stretching yourself and expanding your comfort zone, which feels uncomfortable. And that phrase of feel the fear and do it anyway, which is a bit of a cliche, really has become my reality for most of the time the past 6 months. But I think there's a fine balance with this as well, in terms of feeling the fear in something and doing it because you know it's the right thing to do, or almost having that fear and that intuition that something isn't right, if that makes sense. I'm not sure if I'm explaining this.
No, it does. It's really hard, and it's a really hard one.
Yeah.
So there was a piece of, it was this time last year, and it just didn't feel right, and I didn't want to do it. But I was persuaded by someone to do it, and I had to drag myself through the work. It wasn't right. But it's however well you know yourself, we kind of will make mistakes, and sometimes we commit to things that aren't right. And it's really hard to know how to listen to our intuition and when our intuition is telling us something that we should just sort of say, well, of course you feel like that, I need to get on with it. Or when your intuition is telling you something that means you should back away.
And it's really hard. And like I said, something that I navigate at the moment, it's like, do I not want to do this because I'm just trying to keep myself safe? Or do I not want to do this because actually it's not really serving me anymore and I don't want to be doing that for the greater good of where I want to be? I suppose, like you've just said, it's a test and learn almost, isn't it? That there isn't a right answer to that.
No, it's hard. You know, I've kind of lived my life pushing myself to my limits and wish that I didn't, but that's part of who I am. Mm. But, you know, I think we do get it wrong, and that's life.
Mm. And that's part, like I said, that's part of the learning experience. And if you want to be, I suppose if you want to be doing the work or you want to be having certain experiences, you've kind of just got to get used to that uncomfortable feeling as yeah. well.
And that's not right for everyone. There's someone who sort of read my book for me before it was published. And she said she had a career and then she had kids. She said, to be honest, I don't really want to do anything. Everyone says, what am I going to do for work? But I feel quite content just doing what I'm doing, being mum and being at home. And it's like, well, that's okay then.
Yeah,
that's okay. We don't all have to live sort of life by the seat of our pants. You know, just because I feel like that and you feel like that, it doesn't mean that the next person should feel like that. And actually, you know, I'm kind of envious sometimes at people that do just feel content with the way things are.
Yeah, me too. And I think that's something. There's the phrase, I think it was from a School of Life book. I don't know if you've come, you know, Alain de Botton.
Yeah, Alain
de Botton. I say that in my accent. But he wrote a really personal phrase that kind of stuck with me, that having any kind of feeling like a failure is basically the byproduct of having any kind of ambition. So you can close yourself off of ambition and feel quite safe. But if you're an ambitious person, you're constantly going to feel like a failure because you're always wanting to get ahead and looking where you're not are, instead of where, you know, being satisfied where you are. And I think, again, it comes down to this checking in and this balance, because, you know, it's not a great position to be in, to be constantly feeling like you need to achieve. But then I suppose if it's the type of people we are, it's probably inherent within us. We want to achieve and it helps drive us forward. But it's having that check-in to, you know, to give yourself a break sometimes and look at how far you have come and what you have done.
Yeah, agree. And I think when you're operating on your own, it's really important to have a friend or, you know, your husband or your partner, your wife or whoever to actually just say, hang on a minute. Let's have a look at what you've achieved over the last year.
And I have to say, my husband, my poor husband, who listens to a lot of my business chat, he is very supportive in that. And I think absolutely agree that you definitely need that, whoever that person is in your life. In a scenario where, I do have quite a lot of chats with people where certain fears, I think particularly fear of being judged and fear about what other people think and self-doubt, you know, feeling like, can I do this? If they're in a position where they want to be doing something, that whether that be changing career, going for a promotion or going freelance, setting up their own business, if those fears and self-doubts are holding them back to do that work that they want to be doing, I suppose, what's your philosophy and approach to that generally and through your own experiences as well?
I'm, again, probably not the best example. So I had this mantra when I was a teenager: if something scared me, I would do it. So I was scared of traveling around the world on my own, so I did it. I was scared of public speaking, so I forced myself to be. I stood up as music captain at school, and then, you know, I was shy, as I said, and then I was asked to sing in a band at university, and I did it because I thought it'll help me overcome those fears. I don't think that's the best way of going about it, to be honest. As a sort of a grown-up, I personally will push my boundaries, and I have loads of self-doubt. You know, I can't believe I actually won the award, you said, because I think it's realizing that we all have self-doubts, and people's show reels don't necessarily reflect what's going on inside. And, you know, I work with these really senior people who have doubts and who have imposter syndrome, and they think, I shouldn't be here, or I don't really know what I'm doing. And I think it's recognizing firstly that we're not on our own. Everyone mm-hmm. feels like that to a lesser or greater degree. And then it's kind of accepting it and getting on with it, but possibly not quite to the extent that I did when I was younger.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you started that by saying I'm probably not the best person to ask, but actually, you know, the way that you've approached that, facing it head on, I think you probably, maybe because you felt like you put yourself in some uncomfortable positions, but that's probably how you've achieved the things, like, it's definitely how you've achieved the things that, you know, you have in your career and writing the book. That's all been done through pushing yourself and expanding your comfort zone, regardless of how you felt about it.
Yeah, but I think it's I haven't got a really high self-esteem. So I'm confident in that I will push boundaries and I will keep going. But I don't have a hugely high self-esteem. And I think my point is that from the outside, it might look like someone's very confident and that they just get on with it with no fears, no worries. It's not really ever the reality.
No, I totally agree with that. And I think that is one of the reasons really why I wanted to do this podcast and have these conversations, because I think it's so easy to get caught up in the glossed over reality, particularly of Instagram, because that's the platform I use a lot. And behind that, you know, this podcast is called Beyond the Stories, you know, beyond those stories that we see.
I love the title of it, by the way.
Thank you. That really did come through, you know, a lot of the work I did through psychotherapy. Like we talked about at the beginning, all those stories that get stuck on you by society, by your parents, expectations, the shoulds and the musts. It's, you know, what is beyond those stories? Who are you beyond those stories? And what could you be beyond those stories? And yeah, fear and self-doubt, you know, they're definitely there, but everybody has them. I think, you know, that's the key point. I think having conversations like this, it brings it more into normality and people understand that. And I think if you know that you're not alone in it, it does make it a lot easier. You know, we talked about connection and human connection, connecting on that level with somebody, knowing that their experiences are the same as your experiences, I think helps normalize it and helps it make that little bit easier for you.
I think you're spot on. I think it's the togetherness of connection rather than, I do think social media inadvertently sets us up to, in some ways, to compete as well. And actually, it's not about competing. It's about, I know it sounds cheesy, but it's about joining together and supporting one another.
Definitely. And, you know, through that, you know, Instagram, through me, I've certainly made some of, you know, the best connections, some really great friendships, partnerships, relationships on there. It's a really great tool for the modern age, I suppose, bringing that community back that's dissipated.
Yeah, and I think it's using it in the right way with the right attitude. It can definitely do that.
So in the book, Fiona, you outline your mission in life and business. So you've kind of gone through this process yourself. In terms of this conversation, what is your mission and how did you go about getting to that?
Oh, I have to find it now. Wait a second. Where is it? I want to share my knowledge of psychology with as many people as possible. And that sounds really obvious, but I keep coming across things that I'm surprised about, and I've been studying psychology since, well, actually I was such a geek, I used to read psychology books at school. And I'm now 43, so I've been reading and practicing psychology for a long time, and I'm still finding out more. And I just think, I just want everyone to realize that it can really help us live a better life the more we know about psychology and behavior. And that doesn't mean sort of crippling self-analysis. It means a curiosity and observation of self and understanding what's been tried and tested elsewhere and giving it a go ourselves. I mean, there's an example. So when I was little, I remember seeing, I must have been about five, and I saw my parents' friends. She was called Samantha Sims, and her parents split up. And I remember thinking, I'm so lucky that my parents are still married. And when I was seven, my parents divorced. And then I held the belief for a long time that if I appreciated something, it went away. And what that is what we all do is we hold these beliefs that we've been taught or we've learned inadvertently through society, we've heard, which aren't true. And the one thing that does worry me is a lot of people who mean well but aren't trained offer advice around psychology and behaviour.
Yeah.
And but actually, if you take the evidence, you've got a far greater chance of something working. Mm. And so, you know, there might be a tool that doesn't work for you, but it's much better to try a tool that has been tested and has been found to work 90% of the time than to try and take some random approach, which is what we do naturally through life, because that's, we're just brought up to hear lots of different things and we use those things, or we make things up in our own head. And so it's just helping people understand that, that there's amazing evidence and tools out there. We should all give them a go and see what works best for us to make our lives better.
Yeah, because it's arming yourself with that knowledge, because I suppose, you know, you had that early experience when you were 7 where that belief was, you know, was formulated in your mind. And maybe if you were somebody that hadn't been curious in psychology and hadn't got interested in it, that belief could have really stuck and held and gone with you throughout your life, because you need that knowledge, needs to be there to be able to look at that belief and analyze that belief at an objective level. Yeah,
exactly. And it doesn't mean, I mean, the thing that, you know, when I give talks, sometimes people say, oh, do you do all this? I'm like, no. I wish I did. I'm far from perfect, but I'm better equipped, and I want other people to be better equipped because of the knowledge that's out there, which means that I probably live my life more at 80% than at 50%. I'm not perfect. I'm far from perfect, and I never will be. And I'm a bit bonkers, but, you know, it helps me to live with bonkers, knowing these things.
Yeah. And I think that's an important thing. I think whether it's through coaching, whether it's through psychology, therapy, whatever, we're not talking about, like you just said, going from 50 to 100. We're talking about making shifts in our life that are going to improve to a certain degree, isn't it? There is no, you know, there's no expectation there that we're going to ever be perfect human beings.
Definitely not.
And I think your mission is very much about expediting that process if possible. And, you know, this probably goes back to what we outlined at the beginning of the podcast, particularly with children or people at a young age. I mean, I certainly wish a lot of things that I'd learned in my early 30s, I'd known about in my early 20s. I think, you know, that probably would have impacted my life in a very different way. So I think the more people that can understand this information and utilize it however they see fit is, you know, is definitely for the greater good, not just for individuals. I think this has a radial effect on everybody, society, and
I agree. I mean, there's huge impact on things like voting behavior, decision making, you know, cognitive biases that we know about, and yet we still let rule the way decisions are made by government. There's climate change, obesity epidemic, terrorism, all these things could be helped if we leveraged our understanding of psychology better and Absolutely. We prioritized it. But then, you know, that's what I get very passionate about. And I wish that we were better at teaching these things at school.
Yeah, definitely. I can tell you're very passionate about that. And that's something that I feel very strongly about as well. And I think definitely through having these conversations, it helps to spread some of that knowledge, hopefully.
Yeah.
So Fiona, what's next for you? What's on the radar for you for 2020?
Well, I'm doing a TED talk finally.
Oh, amazing. That's exciting.
Yeah, so I'm doing one for the London School of Economics,
amazing.
And
are you allowed to say what that's on?
Well, it's really about how we don't use psychology enough to make social change, and how understanding and using prioritising psychology can really make a difference. I've got a book published in July in the UK, the US, Canada, India, Australia, with Bloomsbury, so a different publisher this time. And that's really about how we learn sort of social and emotional aspects of life and how we all impact one another and how our interactions impact the brain. And that, I'm really excited about that.
Have you finished writing that, or are you still in the process of writing?
Well, unfortunately, I've just got it back from the editor.
So. Oh, have you? Okay.
So the publisher, yeah. So I'm doing stupid Fiona things again. I did it under a really tight deadline and got really bad RSI.
Oh, dear.
So I wrote it in about 2.5-3 months. It was 120,000 words, and that's gone to the publisher, and they've just sent it back. And to be honest, I haven't opened it yet because I'm scared. So there you go. That's the fear thing.
Feel the fear and do it anyway. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. And so I'll have to sort of do quite a bit more work on that before it's ready to be delivered. And there's what comes around all those things. So, oh, and of course, yes, I'm doing a podcast.
Amazing.
And yeah, there's various other things in the pipeline as well. So life is exciting and daunting.
It is a lot going on. And I think that all sounds really exciting. And if your second book's anything to go by the first book, I'm absolutely going to be first in line for it because I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
No, I really did. In terms of finding your book then, speaking of your book, where can people find your book? And also where can they find you online, Fiona?
Defining You, the one that's published, is in it's supposed to be in Waterstones, but it's not always. So if you go into a Waterstones and they don't have it, then make sure they order it in, please.
Ask them, yeah. Demand that they get it in.
Yeah. So Amazon it's in the UK and globally, sort of on various local Amazon sites. And then my website, which needs redoing, but it's there and there's information there, is www.FionaMurden.com. And I write a blog, which has sort of gone on hold a little bit while I've been writing the book because I have no more words left.
I can imagine.
But things like the podcast, I'll post there when it comes up. And then I am on social media. I'm just not the most active on it, but I'm on Instagram and Twitter and LinkedIn. And Facebook, actually, as well.
So you're on all the channels.
I am.
Well, what we'll do, we'll put all the links to that in the show note because I'm really sure that people want to check you out after listening to this podcast because it's been a really, really thoroughly enjoyable conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
I'd love talking to you. I really love what you're doing. And I'm really, really pleased that you connected. I feel like I've made a new friend.
Yay, that's exciting. Oh, me too. And like I said, thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Fiona.
Thank you.
As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on things we discussed in today's show. Come and chat to Fiona Wright on Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, and I genuinely mean that. All the links prior to getting in touch with us and everything we discussed in the episode are in the show notes, which you can find on your podcast app or on my website, laurenosullivan.com/beyondthestoriespodcast. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you'll also find details on there of my new coaching packages too, if that's something you're interested in. And don't forget, if you've enjoyed today's episode, pass it on and share it to someone that you think would enjoy it too. I really appreciate all the feedback and each and every share that I get, so thank you so much. And thanks for listening. I hope you have a lovely week and see you next time.